Ryder and Naomi had Sage, yeah? And they brought him to teachings, and just like with her, all the attention was on the baby. So to get people to listen to the teachings, Sage came and sit on my lap. And then people listened. It was great. Yeah, were any of you there for that? Yeah, you saw that, huh? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, she's checking things out. Okay. So we're starting chapter 12 today, the four establishments of mindfulness on body, feelings, and mind, and phenomena will come later. We'll talk about the general layout of the four establishments and then go into body, feelings, and mind. Yeah. It's very, very interesting. And some of you have done the retreat on the four establishments of mindfulness. And it's a very good practice. And I think people should really emphasize that, especially when they're new to the Dharma, because so often people rush into Tantra and they're visualizing themselves as somebody else. Yeah. But this practice helps us get in touch with what we are actually now. Okay. Which we need to do because, you know, what are you imagining yourself as if you don't know what the basis and who you are right now? Okay. So, very helpful practice. It's sometimes translated as the four foundations of mindfulness, but because it's a foundation upon which you build your wisdom. Okay. So, we'll start with the chants and the visualization that comes before them. So we so easily divide people into categories based on who we like, who we don't like, who thinks like us, who doesn't. And this, of course, leads to a lot of attachment for the people we like, anger, aversion towards the people we don't, and we tune out everybody else as if they were just objects that we have to walk around to get what we want. So it's really important to remember again and again that from one perspective, when we came into this life, everybody was a stranger. But those strangers all took care of us, educated us, brought out our talents, and so forth. So from one point of view, we started out with strangers and receive benefit from them, important benefit. From another point of view, all sentient beings have been our parents in previous lives. And so when we come into this life, we're seeing people that we know already. They don't look the same as they did before. They aren't in the same roles. They may not think the same way, but they're in the continuity of consciousness from our previous life's parents. And in that way, we've been very close and had a very loving relationship with everybody in the past. So to really take that in, that we've had loving and really wonderful relationships with everybody in the past, regardless of what our relationship is like with them in this life. So everybody's been kind to us as our parents. Strangers have been kind to us when we were born in this life and didn't know anybody. And the people we don't like are basically creations of our own mind. We're the ones that label them disagreeable. We're the ones that label them enemy or obnoxious or whatever it is. So when we sit with these three ideas for a while, we begin to see how being attached to some beings, having aversion for others, apathy towards the third group, that all of that is really rather distorted emotional response. Because if we saw things clearly, we could see that everybody has been kind to us. And even in this life, when we didn't know anybody when we were born, they continue to be kind. And seeing others as kind, we want the best for them. The best being freedom from samsara. The best being the eliminations of the afflictive obscurations and the cognitive obscurations. And so we generate bodhicitta so that we can become fully awakened Buddhas and be able to really guide all these kind mother sentient beings to awakening. So that's why we're here this evening, to learn some of the skills that we need to be able to do this. Okay. So the purpose of the four establishments of mindfulness, His Holiness says, is to gain direct insight into the nature of our body and mind, and to use this wisdom to eliminate the afflictions that bind us to samsara. So that's it in a capsule, okay? Everything else is unpacking it. Through realizing the body and mind are impermanent and unsatisfactory, we want to generate the wisdom realizing emptiness that eradicates the ignorance that is the root of samsara. To gain this insight, sharp mindfulness and deep concentration are necessary, or at least are very helpful. And the four establishments of mindfulness can accomplish all of this. So these four are called establishments because they set up or establish mindfulness. They concern not only the object of mindfulness, but also the way mindfulness of these four objects is established. So it's not just being mindful of these objects, because I could be mindful of my hand right now, but We want to understand the way mindfulness is established, you know, and what is mindfulness on the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena are really getting at. So it is not secular mindfulness. Yeah. Secular mindfulness is basically just being aware of what is happening in this moment with your body and mind. That's useful, yeah. But this is something different, okay? Here, the mindfulness is linked with wisdom. And so we're not just noticing, oh, my hand is hot, my hand is cold, the seat is bumpy. You know, we're not just noticing those things. It's, oh, the hand is impermanent. It's changed. Every part of it is changing in every nanosecond. Yeah. It's also dukkha, suffering, and undesirable by its very nature. Yeah. Why? Well, is this some beautiful thing that is going to make you forever happy? No. Okay. If you took the skin off of the hand, you know, we'd be trying out for Halloween. Yeah. And anyway, at some point, we've got to separate from this whole body, the hand, the head, everything else. Yeah. So it's not something that is, it's useful now. We take care of our body. It's useful. But we want to use it for a higher purpose than just our present purpose. Our present purpose for basically anything we do with our body is to get what we like. Yeah? Yeah, you did a great BBC about that, yeah? Yeah, everything is directed towards getting what I want. But even we get what we want, it doesn't make us forever happy. We're still dissatisfied with what we got and dissatisfied with something else that now we want. Yeah, so we want to develop wisdom that really understands our body and mind and all the different aspects of it. Yeah. So that we, 'cause when we do, then the attachment, the clinging to this body and mind, the craving for another body and mind, you know, in samsara, when this one ends, then all of that gets pacified, yeah. And then we can really use our human intelligence to, you know, look at deeper, you know, what is their nature, yeah. Okay, and use what we discover, understanding impermanence, and especially understanding emptiness, to use that wisdom then to make it so that we aren't continually pushed by karma and afflictions to take one body, and then when that one dies, take another one. And when that one dies, take another one. And when you consider that we've been doing this since beginningless time with no respite and no, you know, lasting benefit, then, you know, we would really like to be free of all of that. Okay. So these four are called establishments because they set up or establish mindfulness. They concern not only the object of our mindfulness, but also the way mindfulness is of these four objects is established. Okay. So mindfulness, introspective awareness, and wisdom are essential components of Dharma practice. They are cultivated here on the basis of our body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. Because these four are the main aspects of our experience. Yeah, we have a body, we have a mind, we have feelings, and then we have lots of other stuff, different mental factors and so on. Yeah. So our feelings, and here by feelings, we're just talking about pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. Yeah. Here feelings doesn't mean emotions. Yeah. It means just pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings. Feelings drive us. Yeah. Because as soon as there's pleasure, attachment, grasping, craving, yeah, for more and better. As soon as there's an unpleasant feeling, I don't like it. I've got to do something to get rid of it. Okay, I'm upset, I'm angry, I'm frustrated, whatever it is. Yeah. And so, you know, the feelings, we're so reactive to our feelings. And this is something really interesting to observe in your life. You know, just what you're, the mindfulness that recognizes what you're feeling, and then the introspective awareness that sees how you respond to that feeling and how that thing, the feelings and how we respond, how it drives everything, unfortunately. Yeah. And this is really why we have so much self-centeredness, because it's my feelings, my body, my mental unhappiness, my mental happiness, my physical pain, my, you know, nice, you know, sensory things. Yeah. And just all day long being aware of that and responding to it. Yeah. And responding not with wisdom that understands what our body, feelings, mind, and phenomena are, but responding with, I want and I don't want. I like and I don't like. Yeah. And then our days unfold like that, don't they? Yeah. And we're bummed out at one minute, then we're okay the next. We're in a good mood the next. And then bummed out and then happy. You know, we're really like Lama Yeshe used to call us emotional yo-yos. Yeah. Dun, 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 dun. Are you an emotional yo-yo? Yeah. Do you like being emotional yo-yo? It's exhausting, isn't it? Because we just want the happy feelings. We don't want the unhappy ones. But, as Geshe-la was saying on Monday, the happy ones are just a diminishment of the unpleasant ones. Because if we did absolutely nothing at all, before I go into that, because the question I asked, you know, well, then isn't suffering a diminishment of happiness? You know, if you're going to say happiness is the diminishment of suffering, then isn't suffering the diminishment of happiness? And the answer is no, okay? Because the unsatisfactoriness of, you know, a body and mind under the control of afflictions, that state of unsatisfactoriness doesn't change. It's there. Yeah. And the thing is, if we did absolutely nothing, if you woke up in the morning and you just continued to lay there, yeah, your dream, you don't have to get out of bed when the alarm rings, and you lay there and you don't get up. You do not get up ever. What is going to happen? Yeah. What is going to happen? Is your happiness going to increase? No. You want to turn over because you're tired of lying in one position. You want to get up because you have to pee. You're hungry. You want your morning coffee. You know, you want this, that, and the other thing. But the rule, you know, if we just say you don't do anything, yeah, no happiness is going to come our way. What's coming our way is painful feelings. Yeah, so the painful feelings are kind of the natural thing if we don't do anything. And we have to really work hard to have the pleasant feelings. Yeah, to have pleasant feelings, we have to do something. We have to go somewhere. We have to meet somebody. We have to, you know, go, yeah, do something. Okay. So that's why we say that happiness is merely a decrease in the unpleasant feelings, but it's not the other way around. Okay. So mindfulness, introspective awareness, and wisdom are essential components of Dharma practice. Yeah, they are cultivated on the basis of our body, feelings, mind, and phenomena, which are the main aspects of our experience. Examining them closely challenges our innate conception of who we are and how we exist. And at the same time, it helps us understand and release the grasping at I, which is at the center of our being. So that's what we're aiming to do. Now we're going to, the next few chapters are how to do that. Okay? Because we need to challenge our innate conception of who we are and what things are about. Yeah, even babies have to challenge that. Okay. In the previous chapter, His Holiness said, I express my disappointment that the 37 harmonies with awakening in general and the four establishments of mindfulness in particular are not widely practiced by contemporary followers of Tibetan Buddhism. Yeah, and I remember that quite clearly when I was asking him questions about this practice. Yeah, he was really saying it would be so much better if people did this. Yeah. And then I would like to add to what His Holiness said. So nowadays, most non-Tibetans receive teachings on the Lamrim. And after some contemplation of Lamrim topics, they receive tantric empowerments or permissions. Okay. And they make tantric sadhanas their daily practice. After a while, some people begin to feel that their practice isn't advancing. Yeah, because basically they're visualizing a deity and reciting mantra. And that can get, if you do it every day, you know, yeah. And just reciting the mantra, you know, it may make you feel good and you are visualizing sending light out to sentient beings and it alleviating their misery and giving them everything they want. Yeah. But it's not transforming some things in ourself. Yeah, quite yet. Why? because we don't have deep, full preparations for it. Okay. And we think that tantric practice is just saying mantra and visualizing light. And that is just the intro to tantra. You know, when we get to volume 10, then you'll see a little bit more what's actually going on with it. Okay. But after a while, you know, when people go into it quickly, they begin to feel that their practice isn't advancing. I believe one remedy to this is to spend more time contemplating Lam Rim topics and meditating on the four establishments of mindfulness before entering Tantra. Okay? For example, in Tantra, you visualize having a deity's body. Yeah. Why? Does anybody even know?
To purify our misunderstanding about appearances and our own self.
Wait, purify our understanding of what?
Of how things appear, how I appear.
But just
our misunderstanding,
but,
right?
Yeah, but just visualizing yourself as a deity, how does it purify that?
You have to have the teachings that go with that thought.
Yeah, you have to have some teachings. And you have to understand first how your body appears to you now. Yeah. How does your body appear to you now? Because if you don't understand that, then it's like I'm pasting, you know, some image of having a deity's body on top of this thing. Yeah, and that's not what you're doing in Tantra. It's not cut and paste. Yeah. It's not like, you know, when you were little, you used to play with certain
paper dolls,
yes. And you cut out the clothes and you stick it on them and it changes who they are. Yeah, that's not what we're doing. Okay. There's a lot of understanding that has to go in there. Okay, so gaining a firm conviction in the Buddhist worldview as explained in the Lam Rim and the Indian treatises stabilizes our mind. By understanding the Arya's four truths and the attendant topics they include, we understand our present situation and we understand how to go about changing it. Okay, because you have to know well, what your present situation is to know what to change and how to change it. Yeah. And if you really haven't done these practices and the Lam Rim, well, you know, what's wrong? Yeah, my body gets sick. I want to change that. But aside from that, you know, my body also gives me a lot of pleasure as long as the world cooperates. And I get what I want. And everybody in this world is striving to get what they want, so I'm just doing what's normal. Yeah? And we have that idea, and that is not getting at the root of what our problem is. Okay. So by understanding the Arya's four truths and the attendant topics, they include we understand our present situation and how to change it. By practicing the four establishments of mindfulness, we will become intimately familiar with our situation as samsaric beings in an experiential way, not an intellectual way, but we'll really get some gut feeling of what it feels like to be in a body like this and to be under the control of afflictions and karma. Before visualizing ourselves as deities with a body made of light and a mind experiencing great bliss in tantric practice, understanding our present body, feelings, mind, and phenomena is very helpful. Okay? We will better understand who we are at present, what to practice and abandon on the path, and the purpose and method of Tantra. Okay? So in Precious Garland, Nagarjuna comments that realizing the foulness of the body is much easier than realizing emptiness and is actually a prerequisite to realizing emptiness. Yet, we usually skip over the meditation on the body. After all, it's rather unpleasant to see what this body is actually made of. And we want to go to emptiness and higher practices. We would have more success if we practice the topics of the path, beginning with the easier ones and progressing to the more difficult ones. So all the masters, starting with Nagarjuna and going on, are saying that realizing that the body is foul is easy compared to realizing the emptiness of the body. Yeah? And yet, I just told you a few days ago in another talk about how I was asked by a particular center to talk about the mindfulness of the body. And I started talking about the foulness of the body. That's the first topic you start with. And they did not like it. And actually, many of the people were not totally new people. They had done some study before. But you know, if you were raised in certain climates with the body is beautiful and your body will give you much pleasure and just do this and this and you will become more beautiful and do that and that and you will have more pleasure, then, you know, to hear that the Buddha said the body is foul, oh, I hear that. Yeah, because another difficulty with that is if you were raised, in a religion where they're teaching you that the body is sinful, yeah, which some religions do, you know, the body is sinful, then when you meditate on the foulness of the body, you go into feeling, oh, my body is so sinful. Everything I want for this body is sinful. I'm just craving all the time. You go into some really incorrect attitude, incorrect way of viewing the body. Yeah. Okay, based on what we learned maybe when we were kids. Yeah, anybody hear that when they were little? The body is sinful, the body is filthy. Yeah. So, you know, then, oh, foulness of the body. No, I want those self-help books that tell me that the body is beautiful and how to have confidence in myself as a sexual being who can attract somebody. You know? And you pay $99.99 for some book that's going to tell you all about that. You know, how to make your body so beautiful. Yeah. But how are you going to make this body everlastingly beautiful? Yeah. The nature of the body is to get old. It ages very naturally. We don't have to do anything to make it look older. We don't have to do anything to make it sick and make it lose its power and ability. The body just does that all by itself. Yeah. So what are we clinging on to if we're thinking that this body is going to be the source of great pleasure and happiness in our life? And I often think here about the people who make a living and get very famous because of their body. You know, movie stars. Yeah, the glamorous ones. Everybody think, well, many people think that they're good looking. Yeah. Yeah. And those people are famous and people admire them. Oh, they're so good looking. The athletes. Yeah, good looking. Look at those muscles, strong bodies. They can do all of this. Yeah. And then, you know, when you think of those people and they earn a living that way, I mean, they get paid enormous amounts of money for being athletes and for being movie stars. But how long can they earn their living based on their body, seeing their body like that? Yeah? There was one thing, because I like looking at the pictures of the Met Gallery. I admit it. I look at those pictures to see people standing on the red carpet. Yeah? Because really, for me, it's like looking at Halloween, the way they dress up, you know, or dress down. It's hilarious. You know, some of them spend all day, you know, putting on whatever it is that they're using to decorate themselves. It's probably incredibly uncomfortable. And as soon as they get home, they just tear it off. Even though it cost how many thousands of dollars, that outfit that got them on the red carpet with everybody going, ooh. Anyway, there was one actress who apparently is 63. Yeah. And people were saying that, you know, she looks so young. But then people were looking at it and saying, she looks so young at 63, but how much does that have to do with plastic? Because it looked like, you know, because when you get old, your collagen goes out of your cheeks and your cheeks sag like mine. You know, you puff it up with some plastic. So, your face looks round and healthy. Yeah. And now the big fad is you need big lips. So people put plastic in their lips, you know, to make that. And then, of course, you need Botox to get rid of, you know, all these wrinkles or your facelift. I don't hear about people doing facelifts anymore.
Well, they're doing it.
They do facelifts. I don't know, you know, but then, you know, do something to get rid of all these wrinkles. Because every time you look in the mirror, there's some new wrinkles, yeah, that you didn't know you had, that you're sure are just an optical illusion. Yeah, you know, and you think that it's really your grandmother or grandpa that's in the mirror, you know, that it's not really you. Yeah, but for this one actress, you know, she was very famous, yeah, and at 63 looks young, and, you know, like her figure was like, you know, how you're supposed to look at 63, you know. So who knows what in the world she did to her body to make her body look like that, yeah. Taking out fat there, putting in plastic here. Yeah. And she couldn't even, you know, with all the things with her face, she couldn't even really smile. She got as far as this, but she couldn't really smile because, you know, there's a lot of plastic in there. Yeah. So, you know, I think, wow, what kind of suffering does somebody have when, yeah, you were famous for your looks and now you're old and you don't look, you know, their whole reason for existing was their body. You know, and the same with the athletes. I mean, how often that, you know, the Olympic athletes and of course the professional football players and, you know, there's some guy on a basketball team who's 7 foot something, you know, and he's kind of lifts up the ball and goes like this. But, you know, what do you do after 5 years when you can't do that anymore? How long does that physical ability last? And then all you have left is your Olympic medal, which I told you I read an article which asked the athletes what they do with their medal and where they store it. And most of them said in their sock drawer where it won't get scratched. So that's how you get your self-esteem. You go in your sock drawer and you know, I mean, it could have been your underwear drawer. At least it's your sock drawer, you know? And you take out some kind of golden something and a chain and look at it. And you say, oh, I used to be somebody. But then you have to go, and look what I am now. Yeah. And, you know, it must be horrible for those people who really don't want to grow old. And yet that's what happens to us, isn't it? Yeah. So how do we make our mind comfortable with understanding this? Yeah. And not just that we'll lose our looks, yeah, but that we'll lose our ability to do what we used to do. Yeah. Yeah. And then you have to ask other people for help. I used to be able to open jars. Now I have to ask my jar opener. Yeah. And I used to be able to lift heavy suitcases. Used to. Yeah. Not anymore. Okay. So, you know, how do we make our mind and our self-image comfortable with this kind of change that we don't want and that society tells you is bad? Nobody wants to get older. Yeah. Actually, to tell you the truth, yeah, I feel like I'm more grounded now than I was when I was young. Yeah. And I remember a friend once telling me that he wants to stop rebirth because he doesn't want to go through adolescence again. Yeah, was adolescence fun? Yeah, you want to go back to being an adolescent with your hormones going totally crazy? Yeah, and your mind going crazy along with your hormones? Okay, but, you know, when we have a body that we are influenced physically, you know, by it. And our mind also influences our body. Okay. Okay. We will better understand who we are at present, what to practice and abandon on the path, and the purpose and method of Tantra if we practice the Lamrim and the four establishments of mindfulness first. Okay, yeah. And then Nagarjuna comments that realizing the foulness of the body is much easier than realizing emptiness and is actually a prerequisite for realizing emptiness. Yet, we usually skip over the meditation on the body. We don't like to do it. Okay. And go to emptiness and higher practices. Yeah. I don't want to look at what this body is. But boy, I feel great when I visualize myself as Tara or as, you know, Manjushri or whoever it is. Yeah. We would have more success if we practice the topics of the path, beginning with the easier ones and progressing to the more difficult ones. Mindfulness on the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena leads us to understand impermanence and emptiness. These four objects are composed of parts. The body is a collection of physical components. The others, the mind, the feeling minds, and most of the mental factors, which you fall into the phenomena category. So these are all continuums composed of moments of consciousness. So they don't have physical parts, but they have moments of time in their continuum. They exist by being merely designated independence on their parts. They also arise due to causes and conditions and are thus dependent on those as well. Okay. Can we control all the causes and conditions that influence our body? No. If we want to have more influence on our future body, we could do that now, okay, by creating virtue that will help us to have an upper rebirth and, you know, healthy and attractive and so on, okay? But once you land in a body, then you're with that one for the duration of that life, yeah? Anything that is dependent on other factors is not a self-enclosed phenomena and cannot exist inherently. So when we're doing mindfulness of the body, we really are looking closely at all the different parts that make up the body. Okay? And when you start looking closely at that, then you can, you know, and you've heard a little bit of teachings on emptiness, you can't not realize that there's parts and then our mind gives them a name. Okay. So when you're really doing, let's say, mindfulness of, let's say, your hand, you know, and you start looking at the parts. I mean, there's the skin, the muscles, the tendons, the bones. How many bones are there that make up your hand? There's a lot of them. Yeah. Many, many, many bones. Many different muscles. Because there has to be, because look at all the things we can do with our hand. So many muscles and tendons, many nerves, a lot of blood going through, a lot of bones. And when you really focus on all those individual parts, then it's like, well, what makes it a hand? There's just a bunch of parts here. What makes it a hand? Oh, I put the parts together. Yeah. And see them as one object. And I give that object a name, hand. But it's interesting because we're seeing it as one object. Is your hand one object? It's made of lots of little objects. When you focus on all the little objects, you can't find the hand anymore. Yeah. So this is getting us to look at impermanence. Yeah, and emptiness and dependent arising. Okay. Okay, so all of these exist by being merely designated independence on their parts. They also arise due to causes and conditions and are thus dependent on those as well. Anything that is dependent on other factors that are not it is not a self. They are not self-enclosed phenomena and cannot exist inherently. It is empty of inherent existence. Similarly, the person, I, the thing that is most important to us, I, me, yeah, is designated independence on all these parts, parts of the body, different moments of mind, and the I, too, lacks findability when we search for it using analytical wisdom. So this understanding of emptiness is essential for the practice of Tantra to bring good results and not devolve into simply chanting mantra. Okay? To practice the four establishments of mindfulness successfully, the guidance of a qualified spiritual mentor who is experienced in this meditation is necessary. Following his or her instructions, we learn the context within which these meditations are to be done. They're to be done within the context of the worldview, the Buddhist worldview, not in the context of advertising and what society and media tell us. Okay? So we have to really understand what the Buddhist worldview is. Okay? They're done. These meditations are done with a certain motivation, the aspiration for liberation or bodhicitta. Okay? So we have to understand, you know, the context that we're doing these in, the motivation with which we're doing them, and then how to do them. Okay? So there's probably one, my guess is it's a tick. Yeah. So the tick heard something about the Dharma. May it have a better rebirth in the future. Yeah. So it is important to study well the sutras and commentaries on the four establishments of mindfulness, and also the sutras and commentaries on the mindfulness of the breath, because when you get into the sutra on the mindfulness of the breath, it actually encompasses mindfulness on the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. It's not just on the breath. So in the Sanskrit tradition, these are the things that you want to study. Yeah, the Sutra on the Ten Grounds, and then the fourth chapter of Maitreya's Ornament of Realizations, Abhisamaya Alankara. In the Pali tradition, there are the Greater Discourse on the Establishments of Mindfulness, the Mahasatipatthana Sutra, the Discourse on the Establishments of Mindfulness, the Discourse or the Sutra on Mindfulness of Breathing, and the Sutra on the Mindfulness of the Body. Okay, so you want to learn those things. So some teachers teach the four establishments of mindfulness, especially mindfulness of the breath, as a means to develop serenity and concentration. Others teach it as a method leading to insight. And in the Theravada tradition now, how you're taught depends very much on the particular teacher. Some will teach, work to gain serenity first and use the breath as an object, to start with, and then it turns into a nimitta and so on and so forth. But then other people start teaching it as an insight practice. So it really depends. Some teachers emphasize developing serenity first, some insight first. At the end of the day, you have to put both of them together. Yeah. Okay. So the mindfulness of the breath may be used in either way, serenity, to develop serenity or insight, or in both ways. Training the mind to be continually mindful of the meditation object stabilizes and calms the mind, which increases concentration. And mindfulness also knows its object and its characteristics and its qualities well, generating the understanding that leads to insight. So in mindfulness, you know, it's not just I'm mindful of my hand. What are the characteristics of my hand? Okay, well, there's some hardness. There's some fluid, you know. There's air in there somewhere. There's, you know, all sorts of stuff going on, lots of different characteristics. The qualities of my hand, the function of my hand, okay. And so really understanding that, then you see that the hand isn't just one solid, concrete object, yeah, that only has one purpose or one function, but there's a whole lot going on. And on top of all this whole lot going on, we just give it one simple word. And that's the way the hand comes into being. Before we give it that word, it's just all these different characteristics and different parts and so on. So this chapter and the next one combine the explanations of both the Sanskrit and the Pali traditions, which are either very similar or they complement each other very well. Since the Sanskrit Sutra, the Sutra on the Ten Grounds, and the Pali Sutra, the Establishment of Mindfulness, are worded in a similar manner, we'll use the Pali passages here, because the Sanskrit English translation has a lot more stuff going on. It was easier for this just to use the Pali. Okay, so introduction to the Four Establishments of Mindfulness. So the precious jewel on the Crown Sutra outlines the function of thoroughly pure mindfulness as follows. Okay, thoroughly pure mindfulness. The mindfulness that ensures the non-arising of the afflictions. The mindfulness that ensures that no opening is given to the ills. The mindfulness that ensures that one does not venture on false or bad paths. The mindfulness that guards one's mind like a guard at the door against all non-virtuous minds and mental factors. So this is called thoroughly pure mindfulness. Okay, so one aspect of mindfulness is the non-arising of the afflictions. When your mind is free of afflictions, mindfulness is there. Then one function of mindfulness is that it gives no openings to the afflictions. Okay, another aspect is it ensures that we do not venture on false or bad paths. So we're mindful of our view all the time. Yeah. What is our view? How are we looking at things? Yeah. Are we looking at things as, you know, will this benefit me? And, you know, or is it beautiful? Or how can I get it? Or is it better than somebody else's thermos? Is that how we're looking at this? Or are we looking at it as something that has a bunch of different parts and then is given a definition and given a name, you know? And, you know, so what is our view? How are we looking at this? And it's also the mindfulness that guards one's mind, like a guard at the door against all non-virtuous minds and mental factors. So when we're mindful of our topic, you know, the object at hand, then, and we're mindful in a virtuous way, then, you know, non-virtuous minds cannot pop up. If our mindfulness is strong. Okay, so that's thoroughly pure mindfulness. Of the 37 harmonies, the four establishments of mindfulness are explained at the beginning. They're the first of the 37. Because all 37 harmonies must be cultivated with mindfulness. The chief objects for us to be mindful of are the bodies, feeling, mind, and phenomena, because these are the basis of designation of the I or the person. Who am I? Did you ask that question some point in your life? Who am I or what am I? Well, we're the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. And they're the basis of designation upon which we say me, I, my, or mine. So establishing mindfulness on these four involves understanding their nature, their dependence, their function, and reasoning. And we went through this in one of the earlier volumes. Let's see. See, approaching the Buddhist path, pages 205 to 7 for the explanation of these four principles. Those four principles with which you look at something. Okay, so the nature, you know, our body, physical in nature. There's the nature of hardness. There's the nature of cohesiveness. There's the nature of motility. There's the nature of heat, you know. So their nature. Then we have to understand the dependence. What does the body depend on? Depends on the earth, water, fire, air, space. It depends on, you know, all the food we eat. It depends on our parents. It depends on exercise. It depends on a lot of different things. So understanding what the existence of the body depends on. If we really understood this, we would take care better care of our body. We wouldn't be couch potatoes, you know. But we would have energy to, you know, go out and work in the forest and do things. We would understand their function. What is the function of the body? Well, Dharma tells us it makes poo and pee. It is a, you know, that's the function of it. It makes excrement. It makes earwax. It makes the sleep in your eyes. It makes smells. It makes sweat. It grows hair. It gets dirty. So, you know, we would understand our body better. And I want to add here that understanding our body, and especially the foulness of the body, is not so that we hate our body. Hating our body is not the purpose of this meditation, And this is very, very clearly indicated when you study the Vinaya and how the first, how the establishment against killing was set up. What was the, origin story of that? So, the Buddha had taught mindfulness of the body, and there was a group of monks that were meditating on this, especially on the foulness of the body. really, really diligently, you know, day and night, the foulness of the body, the foulness of the body. And at one point, just meditating only on this, not on other things, they began to hate their body. And why do I have this body? This body is disgusting. I don't want to have this body. But because these monks did not understand, you know, many things, they thought that getting rid of this body will lead to liberation, or at least if it doesn't, then I don't have this awful, foul body. So they asked one of the other monks to kill them because they didn't want to have this body anymore. So one monk, when, you know, somebody would say, kill me, he would go and kill them, stab them and kill them. Another one would do, and he'd stab them because they were asking. And the Buddha came back at some point and said, there used to be a whole lot of monks here. What's going on? Where did they go? And, you know, the one that was remaining said, well, they asked me to kill them because they didn't want to have this body anymore. The body's foul. And the Buddha said, can you imagine what the Buddha said? You know, he just decimated the Sangha. This guy. But they also had meditated incorrectly. Yeah. They thought that the purpose of this was hating their body, or they just let their body go down the road to have that conclusion of I hate it, I want to get rid of it. I can't wait to die. Let's have somebody, you know, kill me. And not realizing that if you want to get out of samsara, you need this body, because this kind of body is extremely difficult to get. And the human intelligence that comes with it is, you know, very, very valuable. And we have to use it, so we have to take care of our body. Yeah. They didn't understand that because they were meditating in a lopsided way. Yeah. So whenever you do a meditation, you have to make sure that you're seeing multiple sides of whatever it is you're meditating on. Yeah. Because otherwise you get wrong conceptions, like these monks did. Yeah. And when the Buddha said to this monk, why did you kill them? Well, they asked me to. Buddha said, you fool. Yeah. So a definition of the establishment of mindfulness is an exalted knower, that means a wisdom mind, of someone who has entered a path that is included within either mindfulness or wisdom, that meditates on the four, bodies, feelings, mind, and phenomena, through examining the specific and general characteristics of each of them. That's a long definition. Let me read it again. Okay. So it's an exalted knower of someone who has entered either the hearer path or the bodhisattva path. And this exalted knower is included within either mindfulness or wisdom that meditates on these four objects, bodies, feelings, minds, and phenomena. How does it meditate on them? By examining their specific and general characteristics of each of these four. Okay. The general characteristics are impermanence, nature of dukkha, having the nature of dukkha, you know, and selflessness. Yeah. Sometimes you throw in there emptiness and selflessness, you know. So you have to understand, those are the general characteristics. Then specific characteristics are, well, what makes the body a body and feelings the feelings? You know, well, the body is made of, you know, physical things, molecules and atoms that are arranged in a certain way. It can do different functions, whereas the mind consists of different moments of mind, different moments of feeling, and they're arranged in a certain way. Okay, so you have the mindfulness is of the specific qualities as well that are unique to that one object, as well as the general qualities that all four objects share. Okay. So although this definition places this practice as one accomplished by a person who has already entered a path of any of the three vehicles, it is also done by people who have not yet entered a path. You can't wait until you've accomplished something, you know, to do the practice. You know, sometimes when you read, oh, this is such and such, and it gives the definition of what it becomes when you've really understood it and really developed it. Okay. So then people begin to think, oh, well, I have to have that already in order to meditate on that topic. Yeah. But no, I mean, how do you get the wisdom understanding those four objects? It's by doing the mindfulness on the four establishments. Okay, is that making some sense to you? I don't know if I explained it okay. Yeah. Okay. So this practice is powerful and beneficial for everyone. But you have to understand the context and the purpose, yeah, of it, yeah, and how to do it correctly. In the four establishments of mindfulness, the meaning of mindfulness is slightly different than in other contexts. As before, here mindfulness functions to keep the mind on its chosen objects. That's common in all the ways. Okay. In addition, it is combined with powerful wisdom that understands the four objects. So this is one of the key differences between secular mindfulness and Buddhist mindfulness. Buddhist mindfulness is, you know, conjoined with wisdom. Thus, establishing the mindfulness means to place our mindfulness on an object comprehended by wisdom. Oh, and I want to emphasize, to give an example of difference between, you know, knowing why and how to do mindfulness of these four and secular mindfulness. I was living in one place and I went to a meeting of people who were studying under Thay, Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, and so they were sharing their mindfulness, you know, what they understood from their mindfulness practice of the last week. And many people had, you know, good kind of ahas of how their mind works. But somebody else said, oh, I was in a park and I was mindful of the children playing. And I watched them on the swings having a good time. And I watched them on the, you know, the thing that you push and it turns, you know. I watched them on that. They were having a good time. I watched them on the slides have a good time. And that was her mindfulness practice for the week. You know, what she remained in her mind. And I thought, how does watching children in the park lead, you know, how is that going to lead to understanding impermanence, dukkha, and emptiness? It's not. You're just going to enjoy watching the kids have a good time. Yeah. Whereas, so that's what you do with secular mindfulness. You're aware of what's happening at this moment and, you know, your feelings. But if you were doing that with Buddhist mindfulness, yeah, you would be, for example, asking yourself, why does noticing all those children run around in that fashion act as a cause for me having the mental feeling of happiness? Why does that make me happy? Yeah. What's the cause? What's the nature of that kind of happiness? How long is it going to last? Is it based on something that is, you know, something reliable that will lead you to understanding of your life? Okay. So for me, you know, just watching what that person said and then watching, I kind of felt like, you know, Geshe Sonam Rinchen was, you know, going, okay, there's this and this and this, this, they're, you know, getting missed. Okay. Okay. Thus, establishing mindfulness means to place our mindfulness on an object comprehended by wisdom. Of the four objects, body refers to three kinds of body, internal, external, and both internal and external. Don't you love that? The internal body, the external body, and both. Okay, we'll get into describing what these are. Well, here it is. The internal body consists of the five sense faculties, such as the eye faculty. These are subtle forms located in the coarse sense organ. So the coarse sense organs are our eyeballs, our ears, and the, what do you call it, inside the inner ear, the horse, the stiff stirrup and the axle or something, you know? Okay, so that's the, you know, the, okay, that's the external one, okay? External with our nose are all, you know, are, well, our nose, okay? And the organs that detect the, you know, and with the mouth, with taste, it's the tongue, yeah? And with body, it's, you know, the, you know, mostly the skin, the external object, okay, that feels hot and cold, smooth and rough, hard and soft. Okay. So the internal body I just told you the external one. The internal body is the actual subtle faculties that are within the external objects. So within the eye, you know, you have the eye faculty. Some people think it might be the rods and cones on the retina, you know. In the ear, you know, what is it actually that, you know, it's not this big thing. It would probably be the, you know, something going on with the inner, inside the ear and the nerve that transmits the data to the brain. Similar with the eyes, you have the optic nerve. You know, the subtle organ in our nose that actually does the smelling. Yeah. and the taste buds, you know, on the mind. In other words, the inner are the actual faculties. And these are described as very subtle material, okay? So if we were all scientists, maybe we would be able to know how to describe that better. Venerable Jigme isn't here tonight. Do you know? No? Okay. Okay. So the internal body consists of the five sense faculties, sometimes called the five sense powers, okay, that are inside of the big thing. Yeah. These are subtle forms located in the coarse sense organ. So this is the coarse sense organ. Okay. They are considered internal, the faculties, the powers, because they are associated with our mind in that they are able, in that they enable our sense consciousnesses to perceive the external objects. So they're the exact thing that I guess on a physical level would start sending the electric impulses to the brain. So we could say that we experience something. The external body refers to the environment and the things in it that are the five sense objects. Okay. So we had the sense faculties way inside the coarse sense object, and then we have the external objects. So the external body refers to the environment and things in it that are the five sense objects. Visual sights, the things we see, sounds we hear, smell, taste, and tactile objects. It can also refer to the sense faculties of others, yeah, in that they are external to our body. Okay. The body that is both internal and external refers to the coarse physical sense organs, the eyeball and so forth. Okay. These organs are external compared to the sense faculties and internal because they are associated with feelings. So that would be probably like the tissue, that the actual sensors are located in. Practitioners meditate on these, forsaking covetousness and displeasure concerning the world. So you start meditating on, you know, external, internal, and both kind of bodies, yeah, without letting your mind go to covetousness, of, oh yeah, I want a healthy, you know, body like this. I want my body to be like this and my sense organs to be like that. Without displeasure, like, oh, I'm so cold now. And, you know, why do I have to do this meditation when my muscles ache? Okay. So you meditate on this. Yeah. Without, you know, coveting pleasure and, you know, having displeasure and being fed up with some, you know, what you're learning. Forsaking covetousness is to abandon attachment, you know, to these things, and forsaking displeasure is to abandon mental unhappiness, which is the cause of anger. Okay. Mental unhappiness, which is the cause of anger. Do you remember who else told us that? Who? Shantideva. Yeah. Why do we get angry? It starts off with mental unhappiness. And that's one of the reasons why our teachers are always telling us, have a happy mind or keep a happy mind. Yeah, and they tell us that not so that we'll be giddy with happiness because we get to go to Disneyland and eat chocolate, but because when we have a happy mind, we're not going to get big, you know, angry. And when we're angry, it's a bummer, isn't it? You know, we just feel miserable when we're angry. It's like, you know, I don't like this. And it's not anger at a person. It could just be the situation. I don't like this. I don't like my mood. I don't like, you know, how my muscles ache. And, you know, and then you're in a bad mood and you're angry. And that doesn't bring about virtue, does it? Yeah. So our teacher's always saying, keep a happy mind. Yeah, I remember the first time one of my teachers said that to me, you know, make your mind happy. And I said, I wish I could make my mind happy. That's why I'm coming here, you know. I didn't say that. But that's why what was going on, you know. Yeah, I want a happy mind. But I was a baby beginner and I expected to have a happy mind by just, I don't know. Meditation was the craze. And everybody said, meditate, meditate. So, okay, I want meditation. And I sat there. The first time I went to a meditation session, they said, just meditate. I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I was sat there. I was miserable. I was fidgety. I was antsy. It wasn't pleasant at all. Yeah. And like, what's all this talk about meditation? You know, it's supposed to make me happy. I want happiness. Yeah. Coveting pleasure. Yeah. And here it's saying you learn to have a neutral mind. You're not coveting pleasure and you're not being fed up with displeasure. You're just observing. This is the reality of it. Without, you know, the opinion factory, the interpretation factory, describing this to you and creating it as you describe it. Yeah, with, okay, I'm sitting here. I want to feel happy. My knee hurts. Oh, can't I meditate without my knee hurts? I want to move my knee. But to move my knee, I have to move my leg. And they told us not to move or to move silently. Oh, I can't move silently. What do I do, you know? And now it's not just my right knee hurts, my left knee hurts, you know? And it's really starting to hurt so bad. I don't want this pain. And if I don't move, I'm going to be crippled. This pain is going to overwhelm me and I'm just going to be crippled. So I just have to move. And if I disturb somebody and they're mad at me, I don't care, you know? You get it yourself. Anybody gotten theirself into that state of mind when you're meditating, you know, and you're just getting really mad and saying, why isn't my meditation working? It's supposed to bring me bliss. Well, part of it is craving for bliss. Craving is what makes us miserable. We're not accepting what is because we want it to be different, you know? And this is where fortitude comes in. Fortitude, you know, has an element of accepting what is. Because what is, and our liking it or our not liking it is not going to change that. Yeah? So let's relax. We don't have to crave for happiness. We don't have to get fed up when our mind is out of whack or our body is out of whack. Okay. So this is a good point to stop. We didn't finish the section, but oh well. Okay, there's something to think about in there for you. So it's really a trick when you're doing the mindfulness of the body, feelings, and so on, to be just train the mind to be aware without forming opinions, without forming I like it or I don't like it. You know, and this is such a natural reaction in us. Everything is I like or I don't like. Or maybe I just don't care, but which sometimes becomes a form of I don't like. Yeah, but just to experience it without all that mental stuff going on. Mm-hmm. Okay, questions, comments? Yeah.
In the definition on the same page where it says, the establishment of mindfulness is an exalted knower included within either mindfulness or wisdom. Can you say more what that means, included within mindfulness or wisdom?
Yeah, it means that you're having mindfulness and you're having wisdom, that those two mental factors are involved. In other words, you're not just mindful of pleasure. You're not just mindful of what this can do for my reputation. Okay. You have to have some wisdom involved there and some correct discernment of the object with mindfulness. Yeah?
I'll ask, but I'm not sure I'm going to understand your answer. So mindfulness of the breath, useful for both insight and serenity. Mm-hmm. I think I could kind of understand serenity, but how's insight?
Yeah.
A little more on that?
Well, the insight, you know, on the rough level, the impermanence of the breath. And what is the breath? Is the breath the air molecules? Are air molecules the breath? Yeah, just floating air molecules out here, are they the breath? Is the breath the shape of the nose? Is the breath the lungs? Yeah. What is the breath? Okay. So you're also examining that. Yeah. And then is the breath mine? Well, I'm inhaling the same air and that somebody else just exhaled, you know, including the germs and what else is in there. Yeah. So is this breath my breath, or is it somebody else's breath? Or is it a mixture of many people's breath? And is the breath the in-breath or the out-breath? What in the world is the breath when you start looking? Yeah. What is it? Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh.
So it's listed the Sanskrit tradition. Why is the Bodhicharya avatara not mentioned as part of the Sanskrit tradition of the four establishments?
Oh, because it's not giving the explicit instructions of how to do the mindfulness practice. Yeah, it certainly has elements of the mindfulness practice in it, but Shantideva's leaving us to figure out what those elements are. Yeah.
A few years ago, I thought I was getting a handle on this phrase you just said, train the mind to be aware without forming opinions. Train the mind to be aware without forming opinions. However, when we brought the Tara into the Tara room the other day, and every room has gotten more beautiful, and I just sit in the rooms and I'm just taking in these beautiful images and my mind is forming opinions nonstop. And then we get quiet in the room and then something goes on downstairs and my mind is forming an opinion about why can't we get that thing in the HVAC room to stop doing that sound? So I have no clue, Venerable. I don't know where to start with this.
Just be aware of all of it happening because you're having the body doing something, you're having feelings, you're responding to the feelings, you're experiencing the feelings. Yeah. Just be aware of all the components of what's going on when you're forming opinions. Yeah. Oh, I heard a sound. Then starts, where's it coming from? Underneath. What's underneath? The HVAC system. Then, oh, why can't they fix the HVAC system? You know, and just how one thought leads to the next one, you know, and ends up with being frustrated and, you know, I'm going to call up the HVAC people and give them a piece of my mind. You know, make them come here and sit in this room and hope that the system makes noise when they're sitting in this room, which of course it won't. Yeah. 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 Just watch all the different components of what's going on in your mind at that time. Yeah. Okay, we'll dedicate. So this is page 330. Wow, we did 4 pages today. Yeah. Then you think, I could read the book much faster. Why don't I just read the book? You know, she just goes off and off on all these stories about this and that and athletes and movie stars. And, you know, I'm over all of that. You know, I just remember, though, when I was young, oh, yeah, the Beatles. And we used to discuss which one of the 4 Beatles was the handsomest. Do you remember that? Yeah. And who did you like? And who did you like? You know, mind is off and running. Now you're all going to think about the Beatles.
Paul. It was Paul.
You like Paul? That's who I thought was, yeah. But he's old now. Yeah.
Really?
And he's, yeah.
He's alive.
He's alive, yes. And he was on Stephen Colbert, yeah. Yeah, something. Yeah, Stephen Colbert's last thing before CBS sacked him. Yeah? Yeah, you got to keep up with the times. And Paul McCartney was on that, and he looked old.
How do you know?
Yeah, and he is old.
How did you know that he looked old?
Yeah, how did I know? He had wrinkles. His hair used to have some body, you know? And now his hair was just straggly strands. Yeah. And he didn't have the same cute smile he had before. Yeah.